And it was like this thing.
Yeah, E-12 Education Finance Committee will come to order.
They said, all right, now I'd like to offer the delete all amendments.
And
so the whole thing was garbage.
I just want to take this opportunity to
welcome
you all back. We haven't had as many meetings as we will definitely in the future. There's more and more proposals that are coming into our committee, and we will be starting today with the governor's budget, and I want to extend my appreciation that we have the bill, Senate File 750, before us, and then we'll also have today and tomorrow we'll have Commissioner Segrin and Dr. Melcher and other people from the department going through different pieces of it. And what we'll do before we start with them, I'd like to ask Mr. Nauman to just talk for just a brief minute. Both of us are actually kind of suffering from the effects of colds and affecting our heads a little bit. But in your packet, you will find a spreadsheet that looks like this. It has, I think, up in the upper right-hand corner, left-hand corner, it says E12 FY 2008-2009 budget. And this little sheet is kind of a summary of all of the items that we have responsibility over. And in the budget book that you have before you, those initiatives generally are spelled out in much greater detail. So what I'd like to do is just have Mr. Nauman explain how you look at and read the budget sheet so you can work your way through that, and then I'll ask Commissioner Segrin to come up and start with the governor's proposal. Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman and members, members will recall when we did the K-12 briefing that I threatened that there would be a series of documents, and we handed out samples, and today begins the actual documents, and we're no longer working off of samples. Again, taking a look at the document that Senator Stump cited, this is the legal size page, and there's going to be three documents that I'm going to reference here this morning quite quickly. Members, working across the top of the columns, we have November forecast 08 and 09, and then a total, and then you can ignore that second, the fourth column of numbers. Then we have forecast for 10 and 11, because we do try to track the tails, what are called the tails, for those of members that haven't sat through this before. Tails represent the out-budget impact of any particular proposal. So if you raise a tax or increase revenues to school districts, sometimes they can be backloaded, and based on pupil counts and things, they can have an effect that we want to make sure that we're keeping mind of. So we look at those. And these data represent the statutorily defined base at this point, the November forecast. The governor's recommendations then slide in for the next set of data, and those are going to be the ones that I think you spend most of the time looking at this morning. Governor's rec for 2008 and 2009, that's the budget we're setting, and then a total for the biennium, and then a difference relative to the November forecast. This is how much for the biennium that a particular line item costs. So if you just look at the first one, you see the governor's recommendation for a basic formula allowance increase on line 3 costs $291.5 million. And then the cost for that in the tails is $417.9. And again, that's a good example, because you can see it's somewhat cheaper in the first biennium in the second than it is in the second biennium. And again, we show a difference, November forecast and the governor, for the tails as well. So that's a handy way of tracking some of the items that Mr. Melcher and others will be discussing. All the line items for K-12 array down the page, and you get to a total at the very bottom on the very on the second to the last page. That would be line 214, general fund E12 appropriations. Shows you the governor's recommendation is $760 million above the November forecast. Mr. Chairman, if there aren't questions on that, I will just move on to the property tax levies.
Please move on.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members, now I am looking at a similarly titled document. It's a landscape form, but it's 8.5 by 11 this time. These show the property tax levies for the governor's recommendation. Here we are showing the biennium just completed, then taxes, then fiscal year 2008, taxes payable 2007. Most of those levies, most of which generally we are not able to affect changes. In the first year we were able to actually affect changes is fiscal year 2009, so we plot the governor's recommendation against that, and then immediately to the right we show a difference, and then for the three subsequent years. Of most note would be the operating capital on line 9. That's where the governor changes the equalizing factor and reduces property tax levies. And again, totals are shown at the very bottom. And since we were talking about operating capital, Senator Stumpf asked me to prepare a data run. That's the third document that you have titled Comparison of Operating Capital Revenue. It shows the November forecast for fiscal year 2009. Shows the governor's Senate file 750. Members will note that when we get to the difference, there's no change in revenue, but there is a dollar-for-dollar change on the levies going down and aids going up, and then we plot a per-pupil difference. So, Madam Chair, if there are not questions on those items, I think it's probably time for the department.
Thank you, Mr. Nelman. Commissioner Segrin? Good morning. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Commissioner Alice Segrin, Department of Education.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, Dr. Melcher and I have to leave in just a few minutes. I have to travel to another part of the state today, so I'll be leaving. Dr. Melcher will fill in for me as well as Deputy Commissioner Chaz Anderson when I leave. But I want to just give you a brief overview of the governor's proposal for you. I'll just touch on the highlights and then let Dr. Melcher and Deputy Commissioner Anderson get into the details and answer questions for you if you have any. First of all, the governor does propose a 2% increase on the formula each year of the biennium. You can follow along in your spreadsheet as to the amount that will cost, $93 million in the first year and then $198 in the second year. That's the equivalent of a little over $116 per pupil each year of the biennium. Then the next big item that the governor is proposing is in the high school redesign, retooling, reform area, where he is proposing a total of $75 million for the biennium. This is ongoing money for every high school in the state of Minnesota. The first year, the appropriation is smaller, and it would be $68 per pupil, and then jumps to $200 per pupil, and this is based on the 9 through 12 population, or our ADM. So this would be targeted precisely to the high school areas. The next probably big area that we want to emphasize in support of our high school reform agenda, the governor is very concerned about growing capacity to support his high school initiative. And last biennium, we put quite a bit of money into the advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs, and the governor proposes, again, to expand those programs by another $15 million. This $15 million will go to not only paying for exam fees and training of teachers, but will also go to expanding international baccalaureate and AP programs down into the middle and elementary grade levels. The advanced placement program now is creating some pre-AP courses for the middle school area. We're very excited about that and hope that we can grow that in the future for our children. In addition to that, we're also proposing some monies for teacher academies in the area of math and science. We went to grow regional training sites all around the state for our experienced teachers to be able to go back and get some continuing educational professional development in these areas, particularly as we are emphasizing the need for more science and math to be taken by our students at all levels, whether they're in elementary or in high school. In addition to that, we had a federal program where we had received some money and established a mentoring program, and it was so successful and so highly praised that we have decided to replicate that program and put some state money into it to, again, be able to reach out regionally all the way across our state, and particularly both the math and science academies for teachers and the mentor program. We think are going to be very beneficial for some of our smaller rural areas because they don't often have the kind of staffing that some of our suburban and urban schools do as far as curriculum specialists, etc. And so we know that this will be very helpful to them. In addition to that, we also are growing our Mandarin Chinese program. Last year we had money that seeded it, if you will, to examine curriculum, to examine what was actually happening right now in the state of Minnesota. And the governor is proposing to start with pilot programs to start to grow the Mandarin Chinese programs. This last year during the summer, we had work groups that actually have created curriculum, examined our existing curriculum that was used, and then have worked with actually China and Beijing Normal University from China and looked at the existing curriculum that has been developed in our own colleges and have designed and will be providing curriculum for any district that would be interested in it. We also had the great discussion last year, thanks to the superintendent's leadership, about whether we should extend the school day or the school year. And the governor is proposing some monies to provide to school districts that would be interested in looking at an alternative school calendar. One of the ideas would be looking at a 45-15 calendar, not necessarily changing the amount of time or extending it, but crafting it differently, where you would have students not maybe missing as much during the summertime. So we're interested in seeing what districts will come up with. And finally, the governor has some one-time monies. I want to emphasize we have about $38 million in one-time money for technology. That would go to school districts so that they could provide additional computers, smart boards, any kind of technology that they would potentially need. We would want to have some standardization to make sure that when districts are purchasing computers, for example, that we have a common platform, if you will, as we go forward, whether we do testing, whether we are exchanging data between our districts and the department, and then thus, you know, onto the federal government. We all have to, you know, exchange a lot of data. So we want to make sure that we have a common platform as we go forward with that. And then finally, the governor has his successful schools proposal, which would be one-time money of about $150 million that would go to reward schools that receive a 3-star or better in math or reading on the No Child Left Behind report card that we have each year. That kind of gives you some highlights of the governor's proposals. And I don't know if you're covering early childhood or not, but in early childhood, the governor is also proposing a $4,000 scholarship that would be targeted to at-risk children, families that make 180% of the poverty level or less would receive $4,000 to take to an early child care facility or a preschool program that would be selected from an approved provider list. These providers would have to be providing very rigorous pre-literacy and pre-math educational experiences for their students. For those families to be eligible to use that scholarship. But the governor is very focused on wanting to help at-risk children, and that is about $30 million of an appropriation. I know you all are looking at, and Senator Clark has also presented a proposal for a scholarship that would be targeted to families also. And I'm very pleased to see that we are both on that same page as far as focusing on some pre-kindergarten or pre-readiness types of opportunities for children, particularly those that are at risk. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, I'd just kind of alert you that there's one sheet in your packet that goes with Senate File 750. That's an amendment that I believe Mr. Melcher will go through, but that amendment needs to be added to the language. Are there any questions for the Commissioner? Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, when you talk about the $4,000 scholarship being taken to accredited programs, will there be sufficient accredited programs in the rural areas of Minnesota for that to apply well as it would in the urban area?
Mr. Chair?
Mr.
Chair and Senator Wergen, we're hoping so. I am not the authority on the different programs that are in the rural areas. Deputy Commissioner Anderson may have some more information about that she can.
Ms. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, I believe the scholarship programs allow school readiness programs and school districts to qualify as an accredited provider. And so the rural areas could use their school readiness programming and expand that to meet the needs of this program.
Thank you. One of the discussions that we had when Senator Clark had her bill here was, what are the criteria for those programs? And I believe they are in development right now. And so we'll, I'm sure, get some information back as we move forward. Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding the Department of Human Services is working on those criteria, and they're close to being released if they haven't been already.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Anderson, are you, is that a different effort than what the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation is doing in terms of the quality indicators?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, my understanding is that the Human Services area has worked with a number of stakeholders on developing the standards. Now, whether MELF has been engaged with that, I don't know, but I know that they have been in consultation with a number of the interested groups. And I've seen a preliminary example of it, and I think that they're very good.
So, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, are they in all input-based?
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner.
Senator Olson, I would say that they have a combination of both.
So Mr. Senator Chairman, Olson. At this point, we're not sure whether these are two different efforts or whether they are one and the same. Does anybody else know?
Senator Clark.
Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, they have been working together. My understanding from the MELF folks is that Human Services has been taking the lead on this at this point, but they have been working. I don't think we're going to see multiple criteria floating around.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Senator Weger?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. For special education, could you highlight what's being done to address the cross-subsidy issue that confronts every district in the state, and cap issues, et cetera, and how this is going to help reform those issues?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Weger. The governor has proposed increasing the special education appropriation by 2% each year of the biennium. The governor recognizes that this is a start. We know that special education is growing at about 4% a year. We need to address this issue. It's a very serious issue. To address the cross-subsidy alone, I think, would cost, what, about $500 million for 2 years. So it's a serious issue, and it's one that we need to address either this year or next year. I'm really hoping that as we go forward, we start to really cut away the subsidy, because I think it is really preventing our districts from going forward with any other initiatives. And we certainly recognize the seriousness. That's why the governor did at least try to start moving us forward in a positive direction.
Dr. Melcher, would you know at what rate the special ed program is growing each year?
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. We've been using about a 4.5% estimate of annual cost growth in the special education budget for the budget forecast.
Does that include the regular program or both?
Mr. Chairman, that's the overall growth in the cost of special education, which drives both the regular program and the excess cost formula.
Okay. So we're not quite fitting in half of that cost in there. Any other questions? If not, would you, Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, what we would like to do next then is to walk you through the bill.
Why don't we, Senator Olson would move the A1 amendment to Senate File 750. And if you would, Dr. Melcher, if you'd just briefly go through that amendment, then we'll adopt the amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, the A1 amendment is making technical corrections to get the bill in the order that corresponds to the governor's budget recommendations. There were some technical drafting errors as we went through the bill and discovered those when the jacketed bill came out. So this gets it into the order in which is reflected in the budget document.
On Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to walk through, starting with Article 1, Section 1 of the bill, page 1. The first change here is on page 2, lines 13 and 14, and this would link the QCOMP, or Alternative Teacher Professional Pay System allowance, to the general education formula. And so you can see here we're taking the current funding of $260 per pupil and adjusting that by the ratio of the formula allowance for the future year to the formula allowance for 2007. So this would result in a 2% increase in the allowance for QCOMP in fiscal year 08, another 2% increase in fiscal 09. The intent is to maintain the buying power of this program so that districts that have entered into the program will continue to buy the same kinds of services that they're currently using the dollars for, so that it doesn't erode. If you're tracking this on your spreadsheet, this is line 6 of Mr. Nauman's spreadsheet, and the cost for the biennium for this is $5.7 million. Mr. Chairman and members, the second section of the bill is also dealing with QCOMP, and the stricken language on page 3, lines 13 through 24, is eliminating the separate cap for the charter schools. When the program was brand new, there was concern expressed by school districts that charter schools, because they did not need to go through the collective bargaining process, would have a kind of a head start on the school districts and be able to jump in and maybe get a disproportionate share of the money. Now that the program has been out there for a couple of years, we've learned that that really hasn't happened. In fact, the participation by charter schools is about half the level of participation that we have in the school districts. So eliminating this separate cap on charter schools just simplifies the calculations a little bit. Eliminates the need to track separately how much money has gone to the charter schools and to the school districts.
Question?
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, with regard to the 2% and 2%, just so I understand it, The governor's recommending an inflationary or a 2% increase on the formula for each of those years, and that's built in. So in essence, are we saying that the buying power for QComp, in order to remain as effective, it's already getting the 2% in the formula, so is it really a 4% overall?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, no. The QComp formula currently in law, which is on page 2, line 13 of the bill, is just a flat $260 per pupil. And so right now there is no inflation built into QComp, and so if there were no change made, the buying power of those dollars would be eroding. So this is just to provide the same 2% increase in the QComp dollars that school districts would also be getting on the formula.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So, in fact, this isn't linked to the formula. It is a flat, and so this just matches it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, yes, this would be linking it to the formula in the future. So as the legislature chooses to increase the formula, it's just guaranteeing a parity that there would be the same increase for QComp.
Thank you.
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, Section 3 of the bill is dealing with charter school funding, and there are a couple of provisions here. Page 3, line 32 is changing the percentage of the formula that is allocated to transportation, reducing it from 4.85% to 4.16%. This is consistent with some recommendations that are a little bit later in the bill that are based on an updated analysis of the relationship between population density and transportation cost. And what we found is that over the past 12 years, and we most recently updated this formula in 1995 when the legislature rolled transportation funding into the formula, the transportation cost in the metro area as a percentage of the formula allowance has decreased from 4.85% to 4.16%, and part of that is due to the $415 roll-in of referendum revenue into the general education formula a few years ago, which provided a 10% increase in the general ed formula and then also automatically increased transportation funding by 10%. And so as a result of that, and also as a result of some reductions that districts have made in the metro area in terms of transportation services that they're providing, the 4.16% reflects the current actual cost of school districts as a percentage of the formula in the metro area. The second half of this section on page 4, lines 4.2 and 4.3, is providing a 2% increase in the extended time allowance for the charter schools. There's a separate formula a little bit later in the bill which provides the same 2% increase for the school districts. We have a little different formula for charter schools because these numbers are without the transportation piece. The charter schools only get the transportation piece if they're actually the one providing the transportation. Otherwise, the transportation piece goes to the school district, which is providing the transportation.
Senator Saltzman?
Yes. On line 332, Mr. Chair and Dr. Melcher, so you're saying that school districts have become more efficient in their transportation, but when you are transporting charter school students, you may not be able to have that efficiency because you may have a bus route that's going all over a district. So would this law then give school districts less money to transport charter school students?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Saltzman, yes. This 4.16% needs to also be read in the context of another section of the bill a little bit later on, which is section 14 on page 9, lines 17 through 30, which is maybe the more general provision, and it might help to explain your question if I could go to that section first.
Thank you. That would be fine.
But what that section does on page 9 is it updates the transportation formula for the changes in the actual patterns of costs that have occurred over the last 12 years. And what you'll see here is that the index on line 921 and the index on line 923 and the index on line 925 have all gone up. And what that reflects is more rapid growth in cost in isolated rural districts than in the metropolitan area. So if you're in South Kuchiching County or Cook County or some other school districts that have extremely low population density, what we've seen in part because of gas price increases and so forth. Costs have gone up a lot more per pupil in that part of the state than they have in the metropolitan area. In the metropolitan area, what has happened is there have been cost increases for transportation, but because of the roll-in of the $415 of referendum money into the general ed formula, the general ed formula has actually grown at a rate faster than inflation. Now, some of that wasn't new money when you rolled in the general ed, the referendum money, but when it comes to transportation funding, it had the impact of putting 10% new money into the formula. So the transportation piece of the basic formula has grown more rapidly, and the actual practice in the metro area is that school districts are actually spending 4.16% of their gen ed revenue for transportation on the average versus the 4.85%. Now, going to your question specifically, it raises a broader issue, and that is our current mechanism is providing money to school districts for charter school transportation and for non-public transportation at the same rate as we do for the public school students. And I think an argument could be made that in some cases it's more expensive to transport both the charter school kids and the non-public school kids. Our current formula does not address that issue, and the governor's recommendation is just maintaining the current practice. But that's something that the legislature may want to look at some point, is whether you want to make an adjustment so that school districts that transport charter school kids or non-public kids, and I would put them in the same category because you have the same sorts of issues with greater distances, whether you want to make some special adjustment to cost factors for that.
Thank you very much.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Melcher, just I want to continue on that and still looking at Section 14 with the sparsity allowance. And just so that I'm clear, the net effect of the change in the index and the change in the multiplier and so forth, the net effect is that there is more dollars for transportation being allocated per district. Is that correct?
Chairman and Senator Hand, yes. And this is line 12 of Mr. Nauman's spreadsheet. There would be an additional $3.6 million for the biennium that would be allocated. That money is targeted to the isolated rural school districts. Districts in the metro area are basically getting the same amount that they're getting now because they're not getting transportation sparsity, and they still don't get transportation sparsity. And so aside from the charter school issue, there really is no change in funding for school districts in the metro area. And basically, as you get farther away from the metro area and the population density gets lower and lower, you're going to be getting an increase, and I think the extreme is somewhere around $100 per pupil in a South Kuchiching County or a Cook County, where you got, you know, less than one kid per square mile. And then it gradually goes down. As you get more and more population density, you get a little bit less. And the only issue with the charter schools is that when you're dividing up the money and you're saying, well, the metro districts are still getting the same amount of money, but we're saying, based on the statistics, less of that money is actually going to transportation and more of it's going to teachers and other kinds of costs. We're just using that same proportion when a school district provides transportation for charter schools, which is an annual choice that gets made by the charter school as to whether they choose to have transportation provided by the district or the school.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, going back to where we left off here in the bill on page 4, line 8, we get into a series of changes dealing with the extended time program, and Section 4 is a technical change that is just clarifying that extended time programs can be either an extended school year, such as summer school, or an extended school day. That reflects current practice. Section 5 is making some policy changes that are related to the applications that school districts and area learning centers make for extended time programs. On page 4, lines 19 and 20, there's a provision that an ALC must provide services to students who are at risk, who are located either in the district that the ALC serves or in a charter school located within the boundaries of the district. So this would be a new requirement that charter schools must make their services available to charter school students if the charter school requests those services. I think the feeling was that the ALCs are the experts at providing this sort of instruction and that it would be the most efficient and effective mechanism for providing extended time services. If the ALCs were involved in that practice, they wouldn't necessarily be providing the services themselves. They might choose to contract with the charter school and have the services provided at the charter school, but they would be involved in the design of the program. Page 4, line 22, would be adding a requirement for the extended time programs to be approved biennially, once every 2 years, just to ensure that they're meeting the requirements of the program and that that the programs result in some acceleration of the students' grade level. So the students are either moving ahead of their peers, or if they're behind, they're catching up. And that's kind of the goal of this program. We want to ensure the programs are doing that. And page 4, line 30, is requiring a separate record-keeping system. In some of the audits that we've done on school districts, it's sometimes been difficult to break out the additional pupil units for these services, and this is just to ensure that we have good record-keeping, that we're able to document the reason for the additional pupils.
Dr. Melcher, do we know what the administrative costs are for charter schools?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we would have that in UFARS. The charter schools are required to report their expenses on UFARS the same way that school districts do. I don't have those specific numbers with me, but we can certainly provide them in the R&R profiles document on the website.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, Section 6 is also clarifying the language relating to the extended time program, clarifying that this could apply to districts, charter schools, or area learning centers, and again clarifying that the plan that the district provides needs to relate to programs that are necessary for grade progression. In other words, you've either got students that are behind that are catching up, or you've got students that want to move ahead and graduate ahead of their peers. And we just want to make sure that these programs are actually providing for grade progression for these students. Section 7 of the bill moves to another area, which is LEP funding. The governor is recommending a 2% increase the first year, an additional 2% increase the second year. It's been a number of years since LEP funding has been increased. And so this would increase the allowance from $700 to $714 in 2008. And to $729 in 2009. This is tracked on line 8 of Mr. Nauman's spreadsheet, and the biennial cost is $2.2 million.
Mr. Melcher, does the governor make any other changes, like to the length of the program?
Mr. Chairman, no, the governor does not make a recommendation regarding, for example, changing the 5 years to 7 years. Okay. In addition to this section, the governor is also recommending page 8, line 30 through line 9, or page 9, line 7, an increase in the concentration formula for LEP. There are two parts to the formula, the basic allowance and the concentration allowance, and both of them are being increased by the 2 and 2. But the governor does not change the eligibility criteria for the students in the program. Mr. Chairman and members, Section 8 of the bill...
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Melcher, I'm not sure I understand that piece. It would seem like if you have a greater concentration of limited English proficiency students, you would actually need less money, because if you have just one, the cost for that one student would be more per student than if you had a concentration of students. In other words, one teacher can teach three as well as one teacher can teach one.
Mm-hmm.
So why would we do a concentration factor in limited English proficiency?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, we actually have a floor on the formula, which is if you have fewer than 20 LEP students, you get paid for 20. So we kind of address that issue. If you only have three kids that are speaking Hmong, that you know, you're going to get paid for 20, whether you have one or three or 10. So we kind of adjust the bottom end by having that minimum population size. And I think the concentration at the high end was based on committee discussion about school districts that have high concentrations also tend to have a lot of different languages spoken. I haven't got current information, but I know there's been discussion of 50 different languages being spoken in Minneapolis, for example, and that adds some complications where you have high concentrations.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, what is a high concentration? Is it 25%, 20%? What is the percent that's considered high?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, the current concentration formula is maxes out at 11.5%. It's been in that that mode for a number of years. So if you have more than 11.5% of your students are LEP, you're going to get the extra $250, or those amounts are inflating. If you have less than 11.5%, it's a sliding scale. So if you were at 6%, you'd get $125.
Senator Bonhoeffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Melcher, do we have any actual data on what the school districts are saying their costs are for the LEP students on a per-pupil basis?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoeffer, the way that the data are coming in on UFARS, I'm not sure we can break it out in a real good way on a per-pupil basis. The accounting for this is in the same account code as we use for compensatory revenue, so it becomes a little bit difficult. I know that some of the larger districts have issued reports that would be available, you know, on a individual district kind of basis, but I'm not sure that the department would have a real clean figure for that.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoeffer, Senator Scheid and I met with the superintendent in St. Paul yesterday to talk about the English language learners program that they have, and you'll be hearing more about this because we learned a lot. And one of the things I think they said, they're getting their state aid for ELL is about 40% of the cost, if I'm remembering correctly, that they actually spend. And they have what is, I think, broadly considered the best program, not just in the state, but nationally. It's highly regarded. And so, and it's got extremely good outcomes, and, you know, so it's something we'll be hearing more about.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, is that does that count the regular basic formula allowance, or is this a program on top of their, if they don't learn English, are they expected to sit in classes where they can't understand, or is the LEP a program that's focused on those students, and so therefore the general ed formula and revenue, as well as this additional account, would be going to them?
Well, Mr. Chair,
are they still 40% short with the XX extra on top of the?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wilson, as I understand it, what they're talking about is specifically the ELL amount of money, and that the additional cost beyond the formula that they use to help educate the LEP kids. And what they have done is really perfected this. I mean, most schools, I think, traditionally do this pull-out model where they take the kids out for parts of the day, and they have what they call push-in, and they do everything in the same mainstream classroom. And they do it by adding an additional teacher or teacher's aide, and they have a whole set of criteria that they use. So it's really incorporated along with the regular learning day with the mainstream English language kids.
Senator Scheid.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, one of the more interesting pieces is that they have learning academies for English. So that I think it was 14 or 15 of the elementary schools.
14
of how many schools?
Of
elementary, maybe 40, 50 some elementary schools have this collaborative effort, this push in where there are usually two teachers, the ELL person and the classroom teacher in the room. So they don't pull kids out for half an hour or 40 minutes. So I don't, it's hard to figure out where, I suppose, listening to this, where the money, how that would change anything for them. But they'll know. They'll share that with us, I know.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, moving to Section 8 of the bill on page 6, line 21, is increasing the maximum pupil units for students in the extended time program from 1.2 pupil units to 1.5 pupil units. This is tracked on line 10 of Mr. Nauman's spreadsheet. The cost is $14.7 million for the biennium. As standards are increased, there's a recognition that some students need more time than others to be successful, and this is going to increase the amount of time available for summer programs, for before and after school programs for students that are struggling, to enable them to catch up with their peers and be successful.
Okay, Senator Wergen, did you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, it was kind of going back to Senator Anderson and Senator Bonoff's piece, so if you want to just move on, I can ask them personally.
Dr. Meltzer?
Mr. Chairman, members, the next section is also relating to this increase in pupil units, but there is an error in the bill. It's corrected in the amendment, page 7, line 12. We should be retaining the existing language, and page 7, line 14 is where the increase should occur to 1.5. The way that this program has worked in previous years is we do have a limit of 1.2 in kindergarten, and then the 1.5 begins in grade 1. So that change is consistent with the governor's recommendation and with the past practice. It was just a technical drafting error. Page section 10 on page 8, line 12 through 16 is the largest item in the budget. It's the general education formula. This is on line 3 of Mr. Nauman's spreadsheet. It's a cost of $291 million for the biennium. The governor's recommending a 2-and-2 increase on the formula. That's $100 per pupil the first year, $102 per pupil in the second year of the biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Dr. Meltzer, just tell us how that compares with inflation during the same time period, if you would.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, the consumer price index, which we were using at the time the budget was put together, was, I believe, slightly over 2 in fiscal 08, 2.1, and then it was 1.9 in fiscal 09. And so the 2-and-2 is consistent with the consumer price index. We recognize that there are some other indexes out there that are reflecting higher numbers, but this is consistent with the consumer price index estimates as of the November budget forecast.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, Section 11 of the bill is dealing with extended time revenue, and again the 1.5 increase. But also here we have the 2-and-2 on the formula. So you can see the formula for extended time growing from 4601 up to 4694 and then to 4788. So that is the increase associated with the 2-and-2. There also is a clarification on page 8, line 26, that the extended time revenue can be used for additional transportation costs associated with the extended time program, for example, in the summer. Also, the governor is proposing that there be a 5% limit on the portion of extended time revenue that can be used for administration and oversight services. There's been some concern that some school districts have charged relatively high rates for administration to the area learning centers, and so that there is less money than there should be available for them to actually run the programs, to hire the teachers and so forth, to operate the programs. This is just putting what the governor would view as a reasonable 5% limitation on the admin cost associated with this revenue piece. The next category is the LEP we talked about. After that, Section 13 deals with the operating capital levy, and this is also in the governor's tax bill. But this is property tax relief to school districts. The governor is recommending a increase in the equalizing factor from $10,700 to $17,590. This provides pretty uniform property tax relief to almost every school district in the state. The average tax rate for operating capital now is about 1.8% of tax capacity. This will lower it to about 1.1% of tax capacity. So in nearly every district in the state, you'll be seeing about a 0.7% reduction in the property tax rate. There are, a handful of school districts that would not receive tax relief in this piece, and those are the districts whose tax base per pupil is higher than the $17,590. And looking at Mr. Nauman's run, those are the districts with zeros on the increase in aid, and they tend to be school districts that have a lot of high-valued seasonal recreational property. They include the Cook County District, Walker, Pequot Lakes, essentially school districts that have quite a bit of high-value recreational property, which is included in the tax base for this particular levy, and don't have very many students in them. So they have a relatively high tax base per student.
Dr. Melcher, could you tell us what the equalizing factor was back in 2003?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it was $22,222. So this is moving back in that direction, but not quite all the way back. We had a target of $40 million for property tax relief, and this is what we could afford with the $40 million target.
But when was this? Was the $22,000 put in place? Was that 2000?
Mr. Chairman, my recollection is that the operating capital levy was eliminated entirely by the 2001 legislature, and then in the 2003 legislative session, I believe it was the levy was reinstituted at the $22,222 equalizing factor. And then I believe, and Mr. Nauman may correct me if I'm wrong, it was in the 2005 session that the equalizing factor was lowered to the $10,700 level.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with the last 2 points on that. I don't recall there being a levy prior to 2003. Maybe it goes back prior to my arrival here.
2002.
Mr. Chairman, historically there was a sizable levy for operating capital. In fact, we used to call it the facilities levy and the equipment levy, and we had one of those for many years. But as part of the changes that were made in the 2001 legislative session, when the general education levy was eliminated, they also eliminated the operating capital levy that same year. And then my recollection is that it was 2003 when it was reinstituted. So we had a couple of years there where there was no operating capital levy, and that is part of the budget adjustments that were made in 2003. I believe it was reinstituted at that time.
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, this may be a technical conversation that Mr. Melcher and I had have a conversation about. I don't recall that being part of the 2001 reform, but we can visit about that and get back to the committee on if it's important.
Did you have a question? Yeah. Senator Bonha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Melcher, as I'm going through the runs and specifically the school districts that this does not affect, the ones such as Cook County, have you also looked at, I know that you mentioned that you were doing transportation, giving them an increase for sparsity. Mm-hmm. Have you looked at what that would give them on a per district basis and how do we have the runs on that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, yes, we did look at that, and there is some correlation there where, for example, in Cook County, they're receiving a sizable increase in the transportation sparsity dollars. They don't receive the property tax relief here. It is really kind of two different issues in the sense that this one is property tax relief. The other piece is new revenue that the school districts can add to their spending. So it's a little bit hard to compare, but we know that the districts that are not receiving the tax relief here tend to be high property value per pupil rural districts with typically a lot of seasonal rec property, which also have very few kids per square mile, so that means
right.
They're getting some benefit from the transportation sparsity.
Thank you.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, as I scan through this, the zeros tend to be what you've described, but I find two that are at five, the single digit. One is Net Lake, and one happens to be my own district, West Tonka, and I'm trying to find the corollary to your explanation.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, Net Lake, I believe, is so low because their tax base is so low that when you levy 1.1% of tax capacity, it only generates $5, okay. Probably in the district. Now, West Tonka must be...
This is the operating aid, then.
Yes, this is the aid. So West Tonka must be at a level where they're almost up to that $17,500 tax capacity, so they're just getting just a little bit of state equalization aid as a result of the formula. I think all of the metro districts had a low enough tax base so that they were getting some equalization aid. But West Tonka apparently is very close to the point where if they had a little bit more inflation, they would be what we call off the formula because the tax base per pupil is relatively high there as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's hard to believe that that's higher than Orono, the next one to it, but, you know, I could be wrong.
It has to do both with the property values and with the number of students that you're educating. So it may be that the housing values are higher in Orono, but they may have more kids, you know, per family attending school there. So it's all taking the total tax base and dividing it by the total number of kids that are attending school.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, moving on to Section 15 of the bill, page 9, lines 31 through going on to page 10, the governor is recommending some changes in the equity formula in the interest of making the formula more predictable and simplifying the calculation somewhat. The equity formula has become very difficult for school districts to deal with in their budgeting because the variables that drive the formula are statewide or regional numbers that are very hard to project, such as the state average referendum revenue drives what your low referendum portion of this funding would be. So in order to know what a district will get in low referendum equity aid, you have to know the state average referendum per pupil. So anytime any district in the state has an election, that's going to drive or affect the amount of revenue in that category. It gets to be very difficult to pin down. The same thing is true of the regional 95th percentile of referendum revenue per pupil. So if you have a district that has a referendum levy and they're close to the 95th percentile, that's going to, you know, affect all of the other districts in the region, and it may be actually after the fiscal year is over before you know if you're going to qualify for equity revenue or not. And it makes it difficult for districts to budget. So the goal here was not to change the distribution of equity revenue or to do so minimally, but to make the formula more stable. So what we did was we said, well, what is the 95th percentile? And we looked at the numbers, and it came out where it was approximately 27% of the formula allowance. So the proposal here was to say, instead of looking at the 95th percentile, we'll substitute in 27% of the formula allowance. And once the legislature goes home, we'll know exactly what that number is, and we won't have to keep recalculating. The same thing is true with the low referendum revenue. The low referendum revenue is based on 10% of the state average referendum per pupil unit. Well, based on current data, that's about 1.5% of the formula allowance. So again, we wanted to substitute a stable number for a very unstable, unpredictable number and keep the distribution pretty much the way it is. Anytime you start changing any formulas, you're going to end up with winners and losers. And so to avoid that from happening here, we put in a hold harmless provision where for those districts that have a reduction as a result of these calculations, we're just saying, well, what's the difference in fiscal 08? And we would move that over into the transition revenue, which we've used for hold harmless calculations before. So the bottom line here is we have no losers, and we have winners to the tune of about $194,000 across the state, and we end up with a more predictable, more stable formula that school districts can budget with.
Dr. Melcher, excuse me, after that explanation, it seems like it's still pretty complex.
I don't get it.
And there's probably better ways to even streamline it more if this committee can come up with it.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with that. And what we were trying to do was minimal change to avoid having, you know, any kind of significant cost to the state or any significant winners and losers. But what we thought we could do would be to get quite a bit of predictability for improvement or not much change in terms of any cost to the state or any avoiding any losses to districts. I think it would be possible to improve this more, but then you'd be talking about either a bigger investment of state dollars or more money moving around, and we are trying to avoid those things.
Senator Olson?
And Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, do you have a ballpark figure of what that cost is to get rid of that 5th and 95th percentile designation?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I'm not quite sure. I know there are some bills that would provide the full $46 to all districts, and I believe we've worked on fiscal notes, but I don't have that figure with me today. Mr. Nauman may have it, but I don't have it with me here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we can get that figure for you. There have been fiscal notes on bills that have done exactly that.
So moving on to Section 16 and Section 17, these go along with the discussion or the changes that I discussed earlier, where we are taking out the 95th percentile and substituting in 27% of the formula allowance in those the calculations. And then Section 18 and Section 19 are providing the transition revenue, which guarantees that there are no losers when you make the simplification in the equity formula. It just says, basically, if you would have received more money under the existing formula than you get under the new formula, we calculate the difference and we lock that in as an additional amount of equity revenue or transition revenue. Moving to Section 20 of the bill, we have changes made in the QComp program. Changes on page 12, lines 5 through 12, are just eliminating obsolete language for fiscal 06. The changes beginning on page 12, line 24, are the new formula for fiscal year 2008 and later, which would lock in the $70 per pupil levy, which is the current levy. And so when the formula is increased for inflation at the 2 and 2, all of the new money would be on the state aid side and the levy would stay the same. The changes toward the bottom of the page, I'm sorry, toward the top of the next page 13.5 through 13.10, are increasing the cap for the QComp program. And there is an error here that needs to be fixed in a subsequent amendment. The governor's recommendation is to grow the statewide cap by the 2 and 2 that's going on the formula beginning in fiscal 08, and then the 10% increase would start in fiscal 09. Right now this is drafted for the 10% increase to start in fiscal 08, and we need to make another sentence here to make it clear that that starts in fiscal 09. Under our current projections, we have just about enough money in the $75 million cap to cover the projected level of participation in fiscal 08, but then we're expecting additional growth in fiscal 09, and the 10% increase would need to kick in fiscal 09 to make sure that all of the districts that were interested in joining the program later on could still do so. Section 21 of the bill deals with the county apportionment deduction from general education aid. We currently reduce a school district's general education aid for miscellaneous receipts that they get from the county, things like dog license fees or power lines going through the district, miscellaneous fines that people pay. And the idea is just to keep the general ed formula fair across all of the districts. We give everybody the same formula, and if some districts happen to collect more of these miscellaneous revenues than others, we subtract that off, and it goes to the state general fund. Well, there's a new category called wind energy, where school districts are currently getting 6% of the wind energy taxes that are levied. The rest of it goes to the city or the county. And that's creating a little bit of a windfall in those school districts that have turbines in their particular district. In order to keep the school finance system uniform, the governor's recommending adding the wind energy tax to the list of these adjustments that we make for county apportionment. Currently, it's only about $80,000 statewide, but we're expecting it to grow to $160,000 the year after that. And the idea is to include this in consistent with other subtractions before this gets too big and it becomes a big loss to some particular districts.
Senator Bonham.
And Mr. Chair and Dr. Melcher, but wouldn't that take away the motivation a school district might have to do things creatively? I remember when Wayzata was going to have the wind turbines as an energy source. I think that didn't end up panning out. But don't we want to encourage school districts to do this? And if they thought that they could take advantage of the savings, I would think that would help spur that kind of technology development.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonner, I have had some inquiries after this proposal came out from school districts that were interested in investing or setting up these plans. And this does not take away any money from school districts that decide they're going to buy into a wind turbine and use it for science education, et cetera. This is on the producer end, where basically somebody's producing power and they're selling it to the power company, and then the power company is paying taxes. And this doesn't change the amount of taxes they pay. All it's saying is that the 6% of those taxes, which go to the school district right now, which comes to $87,000 statewide, instead of that just being a windfall to those school districts that happen to have a power plant in their district, they don't get to keep that money. It comes off, just like if they had a regular power line going through their district. Okay. So we're not creating an advantage for some districts over others.
Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious how much dog license revenue could be. Are you serious? Could tally that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid, yes, I could come up with the numbers. We have a total, and it's in the millions. Well, if you look at all of these things, I'm sure dog licenses are pretty small, but I think the power lines going through some districts are a little bit bigger. Yeah. And the idea is, you know, this case, it's a very small number, but we're trying to create a uniform system of public schools, which is required by the Constitution. We create a formula that's the same for every district in the state. And just on kind of a matter of principle, it doesn't seem fair for some districts to get more than others just because they happen to have a power line going through the district, or because they're on Buffalo Ridge and they have a bunch of wind turbines that a power company put in there. It's just they're getting their money from the property tax levies and from the state general fund. And the idea is that we want to provide the same amount of money for every kid according to the kid's needs, rather than whether you happen to have the advantage of a power plant being located in your district.
Dr. Melcher, you quoted the Constitution very nicely. That uniform, and my mind isn't kind of working quite right, but we'll have it here in a second. Does that apply also to QCOMP?
Mr. Chairman, yes, and I think the QCOMP revenue would be available to any school district in the state at the same $260 per pupil level, as long as they provide that program.
But Dr. Melcher, there's not enough money in it for all the districts, and it's not a uniform system, because as the testimony in Senator Wieger's committee demonstrated, that not all school districts can participate. So it's one of those things. Senator Anderson.
Oh, well, I just wanted to ask if you there's some districts I know or communities where they have big power plants and have for years. Like, I just happen, you know, just in Red Wing, for example, where they have the nuclear plant, it's some huge percentage of their local tax base that it provides, you know, 40-50%. Do you offset that? Or I don't know if some of it goes to the school district. I'm just curious if you treat all power plants the same way.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, you know, in Red Wing or Becker or Monticello, those power plants are taxed under the regular property tax system. And so as a result of having a relatively high tax base in a Red Wing, for example, they're getting less state aid because we're looking at their property tax base per pupil when we do the calculations. In this case, this wind energy is being taxed based on the value of the power that's being produced. And so we're not making a subtraction right now for the power taxes that they're getting from the county. So it's just kind of a little bit sort of a different animal, because it's based more on the power that's produced as opposed to the value of the wind turbines that are located in them.
Senator Olson, and
Mr.
Senator
Chairman, is there in statute a list of these various items or taxes that fall into the pooling and redistribution that you've been talking about, using wind energy as an example?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, those would be specified here under Minnesota Statutes 127A-34. Let me just, Mr. Nauman just left me a copy of the statute book here.
This is the wind.
Mr. Chairman, this is what it says in 127A-34, subdivision 2. The county auditor each year shall apportion to the districts within the county the amount received from power line taxes, liquor licenses, fines, estrays, and other sources belonging to the general fund. So those would be the items that would be included currently. And then it calls for those amounts to be subtracted from the payments of general education aid that we make to the school district.
Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to Senator Anderson, but she's gone now. But yes,
she's here.
Oh, I'm sorry. The fact that the power plant is in Becker had a great deal of bearing on what Becker got from the state. It definitely created a subtraction. So at one point, Becker received very little from the state at all. So, yes, those things do come into account. And, Mr. Chair, one could argue that if we were going to do uniform, we should fund every student in the state at the same amount of money. So I'm willing to move a little more towards that direction.
Senator Olson.
But, Mr. Chairman, when we changed and took over all the general education revenue by the state, the power line is not having that effect, or the power plants aren't having that same effect. And is that not part of what the statewide property tax was involved for? So you have a different distribution mechanism of some of those windfall kind of areas in the in property tax values as well?
I guess the question would be, does commercial industrial property still get taxed for referendums, operating referendums?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, the commercial industrial property still is taxed on the operating referendums, on the operating capital levies, community education levies. There are a variety of levies that school districts make, and they all include the commercial and industrial property. Now, there's also the statewide tax, and I think that was to offset the reduction in commercial taxes as a result of eliminating the general education levy, but they still do pay taxes on these other pieces, and school districts that have a lot of that power plant property still do receive less equalization aid from the state on these various equalization formulas as a result of having that this particular tax, because it's not a value-based tax on property, would not be covered by that. And so it basically is creating a small revenue windfall to the districts where those turbines are located.
Senator Werger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a significant difference, though, because the municipal, the independently owned public utilities, investor-owned utilities such as Sherco pay personal property tax as well as the straight commercial industrial. So that's where the difference is, and that's the part that works into the state aid calculation as well. Because they generate, now there's some Department of Revenue changes that are decreasing that amount, but that has made a big difference in some of the districts in the past. So it's the way they're taxed, which is entirely different than, for instance, wind turbines or anything like that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just looking at Becker on this operating capital. Would that not have the same, shouldn't that reduce the operating capital aid for a community like Becker?
What number is it?
It's number 726.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, yes, it would, but it doesn't. If you look at the current level of tax there, this total revenue is $615,000. The levy portion is $453,000, and if you look at the next door neighbor in Big Lake, the revenue's $791,000, and the levy piece is $281,000. So, you know, probably the power plant is what's contributing to the higher levy in the Becker District as opposed to the Big Lake District, which is right next door but doesn't have the power plant property. So the power plant in and of itself isn't enough to cause them to be entirely off the formula. They actually used to be off the formula in Becker. I know there have been some changes in the way we tax some of that utility property that I think have reduced the tax on some of the personal property there that may have lowered their tax base per pupil compared to what it used to be, but it still is contributing to their tax base relative to where some of their neighboring districts would be.
So, Mr. Chairman, but that would Senator seem, I'm having, maybe my head isn't working right, but if you look at the last column of the operating capital aid, that difference is that they're getting $62 more than their neighbor in Big Lake, $29. And you'd think it would be the other way around.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman, I might need some help with Mr. reading this from Mr. Nauman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that column is, actually what it does is divide the amount of new aid by the number of adjusted ADMs. So it just gives you a way of making some comparisons across districts. So the immediate operating capital aid column that you see just to the left of those per pupil numbers divided by the ADMs. So in the example that you're looking at, I sort of lost my line here, but Becker was getting $62 of aid higher under the new proposal than Big Lake was getting. Not higher, 62 versus 29.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if you look at what they're getting currently at the operating capital aid, you'll see that Becker is getting $162,000 in aid, and that Big Lake is getting $509,000 in aid. So Becker is receiving quite a bit less in aid. And what happens as you move the equalizing factor up, that may benefit Becker because they're getting such a small amount of aid right now. I don't have a calculator here, but I'm guessing that they're still getting quite a bit less aid than Becker is on a total basis or on a per pupil basis.
And so Mr. Chairman, and what the numbers are, the levy, the property tax relief, is higher for a Becker. I shouldn't say comparison. I'm not trying to compare districts at that point.
Yes.
But the levy is going down substantially from 453 to 275. So that's what the aim of that whole provision was property tax relief.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, what this piece of the bill does essentially is provide a uniform amount of tax relief as a percentage of tax capacity.
Okay.
So we're lowering the tax rate from 1.8% of tax capacity to 1.1%. So both districts are getting 0.7%, and that's a bigger number in Becker because they have a higher property tax base.
Okay, thank you.
Because they're paying more to start with.
Madam Chair.
Starting to get it. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, just to do that math for comparative purposes, under current law, Becker is getting about $57 per pupil of aid, and Big Lake is about $135. I think that is consistent with what Mr. Melcher was saying.
So, Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, moving to Section 22 of the bill on page 13, we have an adjustment for the charter school transportation. This is the issue that came up earlier from Senator Saltzman. What you see here is the numbers are being inflated at the 2 and 2 per year, but we're lowering the number between 07 and 08 to reflect the newer analysis of the transportation cost situation. Section 23 of the bill is dealing with property tax abatements, and the abatement program is one where if a school district has a taxpayer come in and challenge the value of their property after the taxes have been spread, then the school district just simply doesn't get part of their tax revenue for that year. The next year, the school district is allowed to levy to make up the tax revenue, and we've had a program in place for many years that equalizes that additional levy so that the tax burden would be the same as if we had had the information up front about the property value being lowered. So we're treating districts the same
whether their property was lower to start with or whether their property got lowered as a result of an abatement. Over time, this program has gotten out of sync with our equalization system because we've added new categories of levies, but we haven't added them to the abatement program. So currently, we're creating a disadvantage for those districts that suffer from a loss of property as a result of an abatement. So what this section of the bill does on page 14, line 25, and on the additional lines is add to the abatement aid formula those new categories of property tax levy that are not currently reflected. And the goal is to treat districts equally, whether you have lower value to start with or whether a taxpayer gets the property value lowered. We want it to be the same, whether you had a lower value up front or a lower value in the end, so that they're all treated the same. And this is going to be creating property tax relief to those school districts that have abatements, but it's not a windfall for them. It's just making them equal to what's happening in other districts already. Section 24 is the same process, but it's the other side of the equation, and we would add the same categories to the excess tax increment adjustment, where if you have a tax increment in your district and they've raised more money than they need and they're making a payment back to the state, we do a negative adjustment that comes off of both the levy and the aid. And so if we've been paying them the aid up front, we want that negative adjustment to come off of the aid as well. So these two just kind of go hand in hand. Section 25 deals with job zones, and it would simplify the calculations for school district referendum levies as they relate to job zones. Currently, the job zone properties are exempt from referendum levies that were adopted before 2004. They're not exempt from older referendum levies. What we have found is that this kind of breaking up of the referendum into two pieces creates a lot of additional complexity in the school finance system with our three tiers of equalization and the caps and all of that. But it has almost no net impact because there is only a tiny amount of property in job zones that in school districts that had referendums before 2004. So the impact is something like $32,000 statewide to create a significant simplification of the referendum levy. So we've just been kind of looking for places where we can make some progress on simplifying the system without any significant impact in terms of dollars moving around. And Section 26 is a reporting requirement that would go with the wind energy piece we talked about earlier, and this is just requiring the county auditor to report to the commissioner the amount of money that's been paid to the school districts, so that we can make that adjustment. And Section 28 is the appropriations in Article 1. These are reflected on Mr. Nauman's spreadsheet as well, but you'll see some things included in here that you may not have thought about. For example, Subdivision 10 is the compensatory revenue pilot project, which goes to Anoka Hennepin and a few other metropolitan districts. That was enacted in the last term of the legislature and continues forward under current law. And so the governor is simply reflecting current law and having that particular program continue. Next, we move into the repealers, Section 29. And those repealers are eliminating the regional equity gap and the equity region. Because of the simplification in the sparsity or the equity formula, we no longer need some of those subdivisions. And then we move to Article 2, and Deputy Commissioner Anderson will be going through that.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Article 2, starting out, the changes would include on page 20, lines 20.9. We are adding world language as a requirement. As you know, the governor is recommending 4 years of world language requirement in grades 7 through 12. And what this would do is move world language from an elective requirement to a required, and we would add a world language for which locally developed academic standards apply. So we're making it a graduation requirement, but the standards would still be developed locally.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Anderson, I think it's great the governor's including this in his recommendation. I really think we need to do more to promote world languages in our school system, but I'm wondering, in all of our schools, I'm wondering, do you know what the research says about what's the optimal time to teach children a second language? We've always traditionally had them in high schools ever since all of us were in school and probably long before that. And, you know, having children in elementary school myself who are in an immersion school, I've learned a lot about how the brain research, what it tells us about young children learning foreign languages. And I wonder if there's, you know, if you know what the state of the research is on that and whether it would be optimal to try to move some of the language programs to earlier years? Has anyone given that thought?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, that's been quite a discussion, actually, we've had at the department. We've included the languages grade 7 through 12 because the Mandarin Chinese Working Group had made this recommendation, and we took the recommendation. However, the research does indicate that the earlier you can introduce a second language, the easier it is to learn. So you see a lot of elementary schools, such as the one that your child attends, doing immersion programs. That's in one area that's been a significant growth around with school districts and elementary schools. The commissioner has indicated she is willing to make that requirement more flexible than just grades 7 through 12, but we want to first engage stakeholders on what that would look like.
And, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Anderson, I don't want to spend a long time on this. Is really more of a policy question, but I'm not on the policy committee, so I'm just asking. Do you know whether children are, you know, whether the research supports children learning these languages earlier and retaining them, or what the benefits are? I mean, obviously, you said that they learn them more easily at younger ages, but do we know that that benefit carries through for years to come? Or is that benefit lost?
Ms. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I would have to refer you to people that have actually researched it. But what we've learned is that it's not only introducing it at early age, but continuing to use that second language. So it's not just exposing it in elementary and then never coming back to it, but it's something you need to work on to continue to retain those skills.
Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, Commissioner. We were visiting up in Cloquet this past week, and the district reported to us that next year their budget is going to force them to cut their second world language, which they used to have French and Spanish, and now students only can have 2 years of world language. Are there dollars that are attached to this requirement?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, no, there are no dollars attached to this particular item. All of the monies for general education were included in Article 1 that Dr. Melcher went through.
So is this an unfunded mandate?
Ms. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, there are no specific dollars attached to this proposal. So one could call it an unfunded mandate. However, we do have general fund dollars. We are requesting an increase in the general fund dollars, which is included in Article 1.
Senator Rummel.
As I understand it, the general fund increases 2%, which is equivalent to just the predicted rate of inflation. So we are adding on a program. I'm not too sure how the general fund is going to cover this kind of a mandate.
Senator Bergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rummel, I think it's covered essentially in the fact that if a child is going to take 4 years of a foreign language in the same number of hours per day, there's some class that they're not going to be taken, so you have still have the same amount of instruction hours with the same number of teachers essentially that the students are taking, so it doesn't add an hour to the day that they need to hire an additional teacher for. There may have to be some shifting in specialties of teachers, but not necessarily more as a total.
Ms. Anderson.
Madam Chair, the next...
Ms. Anderson, a question.
Oh.
Do you have any data regarding how many school districts currently are not offering world languages?
Madam Chair, I would have to check with the department to find out if we have that information. We generally do not have information about number of courses that students take.
That's generally not something we keep, but I would have to check on that.
Thank you. Ms. Anderson.
Madam Chair, going on to the next change on page 20, section 2, this is just a technical update. If you look at number 1, we're changing vocational to career and technical education. That's generally the term we use now for those programmings. This language has been in statute for about 20 years, but we tend to call it career and technical education. And then on number 2, world languages is stricken because we now include that in the required rather than the elective section. In the next line, 20.32, again, that's the same thing. We're changing career and technical education to reflect the new language we use in that programming. The next change you'll find is on page 22. This, again, relates to the world languages requirement. This requirement would be in effect for students who graduate in the who are seniors in the year 2014-2015. That would be this year's fourth graders. Again, that's listed grades 7 through 12, but as we continue discussions on this issue, we're looking at going even lower than those grades. On page 22, another change you'll find, 22.35, number 6. It has the language, current law language reads a minimum of 7 elective course credits. We are moving the 7 and inserting 3 just to provide additional flexibility for school districts as they look at elective courses for their students. Madam Chair, on page 23, section 5, this entire section is the governor's 3-hour high school proposal. It encompasses 6 different components. The one is requiring 1 year of post-secondary education experience within the high school setting or within the high school years, and that could take the place in a number of ways. If you look at line 17 through lines 30, it lists basically what some of those possibilities may be. This does not mean that a school, high school, would have to offer all those possibilities. This is just a list of possibilities that it could offer its students. The first one is advanced placement courses or international baccalaureate programs. The second is post-secondary enrollment options, which is known as PSEO. The third option is concurrent enrollment courses, which is generally offered by MNSCU. The fourth one is college in the schools courses, which is generally offered by the University of Minnesota. And what those two programs do is they train high school teachers to deliver post-secondary or college-level courses. Number 6 is work-based learning programs under a number of sections in statute. And then 7 is a general other relevant dual course programs and options that may be developed by the high school in an agreement with our post-secondary higher education institutions. Sorry. Subdivision 2 is the second component of the 3-hour high school proposal. This is a requirement that schools must contract with the provider to implement a college access program that helps students look at college access programming and determine interests that students may have in post-secondary education. Some of those interests take place in one and two, which is they may need additional help in college admission and financial aid counseling, mentoring with the students and parents. This also provides ongoing support for students that may need some additional help with academic requirements necessary for college or career and technical programming that leads to a certification, associate's degree, or 4-year degree.
Thank you. Senator Saltzman.
Yes. On Subdivision 1, Madam Chair, and Ms. Anderson, on line 2317, advanced placement courses, is the intent of this that students graduate from college with 1 year of college behind them? Because when you look at private schools, their acceptance of advanced placement courses really varies on your test score. And students don't necessarily even have to take the test. They take the AP course. So I'm just want to, I guess, clarify what is the intent of this, that students just take these classes or that they actually graduate with 1 year of college? Because I'm not sure that we can control that with our private college system.
Madam Ms. Chair, Senator Salson, we actually 2 years ago went through this issue
with AP and IB, and basically the legislature passed a law that said MNSCU must provide college credit for those that receive a 3 or higher on the AP exam or a 4 or higher on the IB exam. We could not require that of the University of Minnesota or private colleges. So as you will see, they will have – those institutions will have different requirements for students. Usually it's a little bit higher than what's required of MNSCU. Generally, the private colleges require a 4 of the AP exam, for example. What this would do is provide the intent that students would have 1 year of post-secondary education, and that's – I say post-secondary instead of college because it may take in different formats. It could be articulated program with MNSCU through a technical college. For instance, Anoka-Hennepin School District has a program called STEP where their students received credit, course credit for career and technical programming in conjunction with the technical college. But we can't the only requirement we can impose is on our Minnesota State colleges and universities. We cannot impose other private or public institutions across the country to accept it, nor can we require the University of Minnesota or private colleges to accept credit.
Madam Chair.
Senator
Madam
Olson.
Chair, just one more question.
Senator
Ms. Anderson, so then our students may not be coming out with 1 year of college depending on which school that they intend to go to. Would that be correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Salzman, that's correct.
Senator Olson.
So, Madam Chair, following up on Senator Saltzman's questions, this is a provision that doesn't necessarily have consequences, then? Is it
Ms. Anderson.
It's not a requirement of graduation that they have a year accepted by a college?
Madam,
or is there any consequence for the school or the student?
Madam,
or is it just a requirement that the schools make these kinds of programs available?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it is a graduation requirement.
It is.
That they would have to earn at least a 1 year's worth of college or, I say, post-secondary education credit before earning a diploma. However, what we can't require private colleges or the University of Minnesota or colleges across the country to accept that credit. So you may have an instance where the student has earned, for instance, dual credit through concurrent enrollment at MNSCU, but decides to go to a college in another state, and the college does not accept all of the credit.
And so, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Olson.
Ms. Anderson, that would not deter their graduation, however, the latter.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's correct.
Okay.
It would not deter their graduation because they did earn that dual credit, for instance, through MNSCU, but it's like any student that enrolls in MNSCU for a couple years and decides to transfer to a college outside the state or to private colleges, those colleges are not required to accept all that credit. It's done by a college-by-college basis.
Ms. Anderson, question. As I understand it, this program that you're taking us through is only in regards to the three-year high school for the school districts qualifying for this extra funding the governor's proposing. Now, as you're speaking, you're talking about it being a requirement for graduation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Subdivision 1 is required of all high schools. This is regardless of if they access the funding for the program or not, because we cannot have different high school graduation requirements for different students. So Subdivision 1 would be required of all high schools, all students across the state. The remaining subdivisions or components of the program is required if this high school decides to access funding under this program. And this program provides funding for every high school that is voluntary, but provides funding for every high school that decides to do so. And how that works is the first year, which is the 07-08 school year, or our fiscal year 08, schools will receive $68 per student for grades 9 through 12 to begin planning to put together a plan. They will work out their plan, decide how they're going to fit the parameters of this program, and if they decide to go forward with the plan, the following school years and subsequent school years, they would receive $200 per student for grades 9 through 12.
Senator Clark and then Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Anderson, I certainly applaud your goal. I'm wondering what your thoughts are, though, about special ed students who may have come here recently from another country, don't speak English, students who have other challenges in the classroom. What are your thoughts with that? Because this is a pretty aggressive goal.
Madam Chair, Senator Clark, as it relates to special ed students, their IEP drives those requirements, and so for students where it's not appropriate, even now under graduation standards, they do not have to complete what a normal general education student would have to complete. But that's driven by the individual education plan of that student. There are special ed students where perhaps it is appropriate that they complete this requirement, but that's done in the context of the student's IEP. As it relates to those that are coming from out of country, they would face same issues that we have under our current graduation requirements, where they would have to meet those requirements unless they have special ed and have an IEP in place.
And just as a follow-up, what about, I used to work with a lot of at-risk teenagers, and there are some kids who would really, are challenged to even get through school, let alone these kind of courses, and we're talking soon, we're not talking in 10 years from now, where we're grooming students to be there. So just some thoughts about that as it relates to the districts.
Senator Worgen.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Clark essentially asked my question, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Ms. Anderson, I have a comment. As our students apply for colleges across the country, they're competing in a very, very difficult environment. And one of the concerns I have with this provision is I know every student who considers whether or not to take some of these more rigorous classes has to weigh the benefit of the rigor of the class versus whether or not they may get a grade that will take their GPA down. And I know that all students struggle with this dilemma. And I'm concerned that having such a hard and fast rule really takes that dilemma out of those students' hands. And for some students to participate in some of these more rigorous classes will really affect their overall GPA and class rank and may affect their ability to get into schools that they may want to. So it looks to me like this is a mandate that has a wonderful intent but is a pretty far-reaching consequence. And then just in completion of that, I don't see when this becomes in effect. I understand when you say the second part comes in effect, but is this the actual graduation? When do you expect these students?
Madam Chair, I need to find the exact place where it should be at, but this is actually in effect for the graduation class of 2015, so that's this year's fourth graders.
Thank you.
So there was plenty of time to transition to this requirement. As it relates to your question on grades, I mean, we at the department, we always promote the importance of taking rigorous courses, and many school districts have different grading methodologies. Some have weighted grading, so they give courses that are considered harder or more weight than other courses. In addition, colleges look at transcripts and look at the amount of coursework or the rigorous coursework they've taken in consideration. For instance, if a student has taken 4 years of math or 4 years of science, that tends to get sometimes considered more heavily by colleges and universities. But that's an individual case-by-case basis and a college-by-college basis.
Thank you. Senator Olson, and then
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Wolfram.
Ms. Anderson, on page 26, you have an effective date for this section of the 2007-2008 school year later, but I don't see that provision that you said this starts for, it applies only to fourth graders. Is that someplace else, or is it in the language?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we're struggling to find that the 2014-15 date as well. But the effective date of the program is also for the funding piece, because when the funding comes in immediately, it doesn't wait until the graduation requirement. So the effective date of the program has to be for the 07-08 school year to match the appropriation.
And Mr.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Anderson, one of the things that Senator Stumpf and I have had some concerns about, and you can see some potential, actually, in this for post-secondary enrollment options through our technical programs through MNSCU. We need to get more of that kind of option back in, but that's going to be very difficult for students that would want to do their concentration there, since you've only allowed three electives by making taking away four of those electives for world language. So it seems that we've got a couple of provisions that work against some of the kinds of options that I think fit the needs of students with differing goals as well as interests. And I wonder if you've thought of that, or just want to let you know that some of us are thinking of that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, as it relates to the moving from seven to three electives, that's a minimum of three, so they could offer more electives than just three. It's not saying they can only offer three, but rather they can offer it's a minimum of three. Mr. Chair, Ms. Anderson,
part of that is that if you have more required courses, there isn't enough time to get in electives. So that's the challenge of what do you give up if you can't give up so much? I'm not against a strong academic program, but we still do have students that I think would frankly would do better even in their academics if they have an opportunity to participate in a career and technical program that they see the relevance of the academics to, and learn more effectively in that way. And can do so because we've had post-secondary enrollment options. We've got a little bit of a dilemma that I'm trying to work out with the prohibition of that where we have intermediate districts. Mm-hmm. But we need to find some ways for bringing some of that back into the secondary level because we're having challenges even at the higher ed level of recruitment because we are not bringing that into the secondary level. And we could kill two birds with one stone. By being able to make these kinds of courses available and for college credit, so they get a head start on it. If we're able to achieve that, so that's an area that I'm going to be that I'm very serious about because I think that we're not serving some of our students well in that situation.
And Mr. Nelman, I'm going to call Mr. Nelman, who's going to address the effective date issue.
Madam Chair and members, as I understood the testimony, Subdivision 1 was supposed to be effective for the 2013-2014 class.
2014-2015.
I think we may need to add some language there to make that requirement effective, separate from the revenue section, which is everything else, or the revenue subdivisions. I think that those sections need to be effective for the revenue. Mm-hmm. And I think the effective date is fine for that, but we need to specify that the graduation requirements in Subdivision 1 are somehow different.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I would concur with that.
Very good, Commissioner. Senator Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a clarifying question and a thought. From a clarifying standpoint, is the money specifically only going to high schools to help them meet this requirement, or will the elementary and junior highs get? The reason why I'm asking, I'm glad to hear that it's a bit further out, but if we're waiting until high school to be making sure that the children are able to actually meet these standards, I'd have some concern. So how far down does the money go? And then have you thought about waiting until a class that's a bit further out after we've closed the achievement gap on the early end, that maybe we should be waiting till we get our scholarship allowances in, because the current fourth graders that have the gap that exists may be hard for many of them to actually catch up.
Madam Chair, Senator Clark.
Commissioner Anderson.
As you look at the entire budget, this funding is directed to high schools. It's $68 per student the first year for grades 9 through 12, $200 a student the second year for grades 9 through 12. As you look at the whole budget, we did consider those issues. They're very important. We can't, it's not just you pick it up in high school, but you have to look at the middle years and the earlier years. And that is why you see the recommendation on the extended time revenue to increase the amount of time for the students that may need remediation services to meet those new requirements and standards. The governor is recommending a 2-2 increase in the extended time revenue and also moving the amount of time that can be generated per adjusted marginal unit. So that went from 1.2 to 1.5, which will provide revenue through grades 1 through 12 to provide services to keep those students on track. And then as you mentioned, the scholarship program is one recommendation that we've made to look at closing some of those achievement gaps. The proposal that the governor is making is targeted to at-risk students. and looking at getting them ready for kindergarten that year before kindergarten occurs.
Commissioner, if I may, you know, the flow of funds with regard to the 3R programs is contingent on those school districts meeting the requirements of the 3R. The subdivision that Senator Clark is referring to with regard to the year of post-secondary and advanced courses doesn't have any funds associated with it, as I understand it.
Madam Chair, not unless they go into the program and go through all six components.
Commissioner Anderson, but the subdivision number one is a requirement with no funds associated, and the remainder of this particular section is optional for school districts to participate in, correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct in the context of every school, high school, can access this funding to go into the program. And so what you will see here is looking throughout the required components, you'll see things like required to have meaningful teacher and principal leadership, to have a data system in place, to provide college access programming. And so many of the components that you'll see in this is you'll see a lot of that in some form across high schools. And so it is our expectation that at least all of our high schools will access those planning monies the first year, and that it is our expectation, we have funding available for every high school to access funding to develop a plan for this entire program.
Commissioner, because of the inconsistency with regard to the first subdivision and the remainder of this section, would it not make more sense to put the first subdivision in the section where you're talking about high school requirements?
Madam Chair, this is, I guess I'd have to talk to our reviser that wrote this and wanted to put things in certain places. And so what we want to look at is that we want to look at the 3R high school program as not, we have separate graduation requirements for high school, for post-secondary education, and then we have this other proposal here. We want it to be a seamless system, and so that every high school could access funding to go into the program, and they can use that funding to comply with subdivision one and the remaining subdivisions of the program.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I believe we left off on subdivision three.
Senator Saltzman.
Yes,
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on subdivision two, Commissioner Anderson, on line 2334, it says a 3R high school must contract with a provider approved by the department to implement a college access program, and then it lists all of those issues. Is this to replace school guidance counselors?
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman, this does not replace counselors. It supplements those services. What a lot of times you'll see with college access programming is that they work with the counselors in the school to identify needs that students may have of a particular population. For example, they may have a number of first-generation students whose parents do not speak fluent English, and so they may use that provider to do outreach with those parents about college readiness, about preparing students to go to college. That's just one service. It may be a group of students that need some additional remediation in certain areas as they find there's deficiencies in getting ready for post-secondary education, and so that service, college access program may provide that service. It is not meant at all to replace counselors. It's meant to supplement really targeted services to students that need those services.
And members of the committee, it is time for us to close for today. We will take up this bill tomorrow. We thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner Anderson and Dr. Melcher.
Thank you.
Thank you. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.